and welcome to this podcast focusing on precision pathways to transform patient care in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. Narjost Flores, David Carbone, and Edward Guerin discuss KRAS, NRG1, MET, and ROS1 targeting agents. This activity is provided by PER and supported by educational grants from AbbVie, Inc., Lilly, and Partner Therapeutics. Dr. Flores starts by giving an overview of biomarker-driven approaches in advanced NSCLC.
So I'm going to set out this stage with the molecular blueprint for advancing non-small cell lung cancer with biomarker-driven approaches. Cancer care has significantly changed, particularly non-small cell lung cancer, in which now we go by not only the mutation, but also co-mutations and anything that will come with that. Initially, we were going for a histologic subtype, adenocarcinoma, squamous cell, and others. So these included large cells, neuroendocrine tumors. Eventually, we differentiated as non-squamous, and we started identifying progressively. And some of us heard the story about EGFR last night at the faculty dinner. And then progressively, the fusions have started coming up. We ALK, then we have HER2. These are not chronologically organized, but organized by fusion and name and alphabetical too. But we have gone from having three targets to having significantly targets and also adding value from co-mutations like STK11, KEAP1, to name a few. And also, while a little bit more behind squamous cell carcinoma, we're starting to learn the role of genetic alterations and biomarkers in this subgroup of patients beyond PD-L1, but also as mutation variants that will directly not affect a drug that you may select, but an outcome and maybe prognostic or predicted. We have PD-L1 that continues to be used as a categorical variable, it's actually a continual variable, but has been used to cut off in trials in metastatic disease, early stage disease, and is still an important tool to make treatment decisions. We have MSI-high and tumor mutation burden that for a time we use it, then it went to sleep, and then it's back up again. We have emerging biomarkers, and thus many of the ones you're going to hear today. This is HER2 by IHC, MET by IHC, NRG1, TROP2 by IHC, *STK11, and KEAP1. So some of them are emerging with targeted therapies, and some of them are help us select treatment at the time of diagnosis. Testing methods have evolved over time. So we have real-time PCR. The benefit of this is that we require less tissue. It's mostly DNA-based, relative simple operation, rapid turnaround time, and lower cost. The disadvantage is only in predetermined mutations detectable. When I was a fellow at Mayo Clinic, I remember typing ROS1, click, ALK. We didn't have EPIC even when I was a fellow. So it's only one gene at a time. Then we have FISH. Sometimes it can be hard to interpret. You have to really understand the breakup art probes for the fusions, ALK, ROS, RET, and NTRACT. And it's very associated with the copy number, particularly for MET FISH. And we have IHC. I think IHC is coming back as we're having some of these emerging therapies. I'm okay with IHC coming back as long as we don't bring back low-rise genes. I'm perfectly fine. We use an IHC more. The next generation sequencing is our preferred tool. It provides not only the driver mutation, but co-mutation. You don't have to be selecting gene by gene to remember all the genes that are being developed, all the biomarkers. However, it requires more tissue, and still tissue is the issue. We had a conversation early yesterday at the podcast about how still 20% of the patients may not have enough tissue for full NGS. It is a slower turnaround time, so it depends if you have it in-house or it's sent out. It can go from 2 to 4 or 6 weeks, and it's more expensive, but it's still the preferred choice. RNA sequencing is essential, particularly for fusions. In a study, this presented by MSK, in which they were looking at ROS1 fusions, they noticed ROS and RET, that a big chunk of these patients may have been lost to diagnosis when the assay only included DNA. So very particularly for ALK, for ROS1. For MET exon 14 skipping mutation, I think RNA fusions, RNA sequencing is very important. So when you get a report, it's key that you read in the report if the RNA sequencing was included. 20% of patients is a good chunk that will benefit from therapy for a long time. These fusion therapies, like AL-directed therapy, RET and ROS, tend to have very prolonged progression-free survivals. Tissue versus liquid biopsy. I think the summary here for this slide is if you have a negative liquid biopsy, it doesn't mean the patient doesn't have a biomarker. It just means that the patient is not showing the DNA or that sample didn't collect it. So we cannot see liquid biopsy as a replacement for tissue, because if the liquid biopsy is negative, you still have to go and get the tissue. Another aspect that is important to mention for liquid biopsies is at the time of disease progression, liquid biopsies are not able to fully differentiate. For example, in patients with EGFR-positive lung cancer, if they have a transformation to a small cell. But they had the benefit to have a backup plan for many patients. I specialize in younger patients, and I'm often trying to look for tissue somewhere in the United States. I have a person that's dedicated to seeking tissue somewhere. So when I see them unable to collect a liquid biopsy, to guess when things gone, by the time we get the tissue, sometimes the tissue is already a fiber, but it still hasn't been evaluated. The guidelines for testing continue to suggest a biomarker testing category one. Particularly, they suggest a multiple gene panel testing, if available, is the preferred choice. There are many barriers for molecular testing. I think tissue, the amount of tissue still continues to be a challenge, particularly as we're using more and more EVAs. The sample size tend to be smaller, but I heard yesterday from Sanjay that FNAs are still good as long as they give you enough meat. So when you have the pathology report, it's important to see how many tumor cells were there. If there are less than 100 tumor cells, it may be very challenging to run NGS. The complex workflows, I think reflex testing is a wonderful idea, but the question is who pays with reflex testing and who will have a clear pathway to get these patients there. There are many strategies. I think education is a key, but the diagnosis of lung cancer is not complete until biomarker testing is completed.
Next, Dr. Guerin discusses therapeutic advances in KRAS mutant NSCLC.
So KRAS mutations are very common in lung cancer. This has been something that has been known for a long period of time, probably upwards of a quarter of patients. Tends to be more common in smokers, although there are certainly KRAS mutations also seen in non-smokers, particularly in certain subgroups. The most common KRAS mutations in lung cancer are KRAS G12C mutations, with you see G12V and G12D less commonly. G12D tends to be sort of more common amongst non-smokers, and there is even regional variation in our practice in Los Angeles. I would say I probably have actually more G12D than G12C, but that's sort of a unique issue in our specific practice. There are, of course, now two approved therapies for KRAS G12C, one of which is sotorasib. It was the first one approved. It received sort of initial approval based on phase, on early phase data. And then this has been sort of a polarizing data set, the phase three study looking at sotorasib versus docetaxel. This was originally a larger study looking at survival. It was changed to be a smaller study with the primary endpoint of progression-free survival. And when sotorasib was compared to docetaxel, the progression-free survival was clearly better with sotorasib than docetaxel. The magnitude of the benefit was very real, but also not monumental, and the survival was not there. Now on one hand, of course, crossover was allowed, and so maybe the take home is that sequencing was not particularly important, but it is a positive study for progression-free survival, not overall survival. The other approved drug is adagrasib, and the study design here is nearly identical. The biggest difference here is that we don't have the survival data available yet, at least to my knowledge. Here you can see the progression-free survival data. You can see it actually plays out quite similarly to the data that was seen in with sotorasib. There is evidence as part of the adagrasib study looking at CNS activity. That has been a push from the company that has developed adagrasib. And there is, I would say, more data, at least, on CNS activity for adagrasib. These drugs, like any of our drugs, do have toxicities. Here you can see data on the common adverse events for adagrasib and sotorasib. And to take a lot of words and sort of summarize it, the numbers are a little higher for gastrointestinal toxicity with adagrasib, but for hepatotoxicity, they are more significant for sotorasib. And in fact, this hepatotoxicity has seemed to be more of a problem in patients who are receiving or have recently received immunotherapy. And the studies looking, for instance, at combinations of sotorasib and immunotherapeutic approaches really have all been closed based on excess toxicity. There are new classes of agents looking at KRAS G12C, and one that I'm going to mention here is olemarasib. This is a G12C inhibitor. This agent has been combined with chemotherapy as well as pembrolizumab. You can see the data here. This data has been felt to be more tolerable, certainly compared, for instance, to sotorasib, where the program had to be shut down when combined with pembrolizumab. As one might imagine, for a drug of this type that's looking at targeting KRAS specifically, there may be some effects of PD-L1 expression in predicting the outcome for pembrolizumab, but there are patients who are going to benefit across PD-L1 levels, as we don't think that the PD-L1 level is going to affect the efficacy of a KRAS-directed therapy. Here you can see a simplified sort of schema of the G12C landscape with sotorasib and adagrasib already being approved. Divarasib has had very impressive data in trials that were not randomized, and I think as a credit to the makers of divarasib, they are actually, rather than forcing us to sort of do these analyses where you look at one trial and compare it to the other with the same comparator, they're directly taking on in their phase 3 study sotorasib or adagrasib, so that you'll be able to see directly how this compares to the currently approved therapies. Olemarasib, I showed the data. We'd been involved with the JDK443, but Novartis has stopped development of that program. And there are other G12C inhibitors, the BridgeBio we have on clinical trial, as well as these drugs from Frontier and Revolution. So, future of KRAS developed therapies, directed therapies, and I think that one question in the field is, are we going to sort of have an inhibitor for each of these specific mutations, or more of an inhibitor that is directed against KRAS in general? Here you can see development of KRAS G12D directed therapies, and you can see these are our inhibitors. We actually also have, there's an additional study of a degrader that we have, and the tolerability of some of these has been reasonably good. Diraxonrasib is a pan-KRAS, or I guess pan-KRAS is a little too strong. It's a G12X. Of course, when you see X in this, it means sort of any amino acid in that position. And you can see single-arm data in second- and third-line patients on the top, both with progression-free survival on the left and overall survival on the right. In this early phase study, the progression-free survival was quite good, nearly 10 months. And there is now an ongoing registration study, which is going to compare this agent to docetaxel in previously treated patients.
Dr. Guerin continues the discussion with NRG1 targeted therapy.
So, NRG fusions, these are seen in about 0.2% of solid tumors. It is enriched in invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma, but as you can imagine by the prevalence, still the great majority of invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma is not going to have this genomic abnormality. It is an independent driver, but can co-occur with other mutations, including KRAS. It is a fusion, but the fusion partner can be quite diverse. There are a few sort of stereotyped, more common fusions, but there are also some less common ones. It's also been considered a potential mechanism of resistance for other driver-positive non-small cell lung cancer. And as was discussed earlier, looking for RNA is going to help in finding these fusions, although sometimes they can be seen with DNA. The RNA is a much surer way of finding them. It has been reported to have poor response to chemoimmunotherapy. I would say that the strength of that data is a little limited because it's a fairly uncommon mutation. Back to remembering your biology, HER3 has multiple ligands, neuroregulin or energy one is one of them. It doesn't have really a kinase activity. HER2 is sort of the other way, which without a known ligand, but then it you know, that is a partner, and then you get signaling generally via HER2 signaling. And so neuroregulin or energy one fusions really end up then leading to the binding to HER3, which then through the dimerization with HER2 ends up leading to the activity. So there's really one trial here, which is why I say that we're not going to spend maybe as much time on it. That trial looked at multiple different histologies, but the lion's share of that was really two diseases, non-small cell lung cancer and pancreatic cancer, with the most common tumor in the study being non-small cell lung cancer. Interestingly, in drugs that receive, sort of accelerated approval, we've always sort of said our threshold is about a 40% response rate, maybe with 6 months of duration of response. The response rate here is a little bit lower than that, 29%, but the duration of response of nearly a year means that in many of these patients, you are substantially, sort of changing how they feel and giving them a therapy that can be quite effective. Here you can see the safety profile, including sort of any adverse event, which as is most of the time you'll see that is in most patients. Higher grade adverse events, 35%, but many of these may not have been related to study. And you can see no fatal adverse events and a small number of patients where you did have sort of treatment delay. The tended to be sort of GI toxicities, diarrhea, nausea, but also fatigue. So here you can see the efficacy data. The most of these patients were previously treated that we have data for in updated data. There was a group of treatment-naive patients. This was 20 patients, so you can sort of do the math. Each patient represents 5%. So when you look, 7 of the 20 responded. So the response rate is not particularly different than what was seen in previously treated patients. However, the duration of response is even longer, approaching a year and a half.
In the next segment, Dr. Carbone describes how to personalize NSCLC care for patients with c-MET overexpressing tumors.
Okay, so MET is a clear driver in non-small cell lung cancer. It can be activated in multiple ways. The most common way that we see in first line is MET exon 14 skipping, but it can also be clearly activated by amplification or overexpression or fusions. So we have a variety of MET inhibitors that have been developed. These are the direct TKIs, and some antibodies are in there as well. But you can see that tepotinib and capmatinib are the most active. So these are both FDA-approved in MET exon 14 skipping mutant lung cancers. This skipping mutation results in the stability and overactivity of MET. And you can see in both, just as glancing at the waterfall plots, both are highly active. This tabulates response rate in first and subsequent lines for tepotinib and capmatinib, as well as savolitinib. And you can see that the median OS is quite good, 20 months for tepotinib and 21 months for capmatinib. And actually, even in previously treated patients, it's quite respectable, with a more than 50 to 80% response rate. So the toxicities are dependent upon this MET inhibition and dominated by peripheral edema, seen in 50% or 60% for both drugs, with grade 3 in about 11%. And this can be really serious if people have experience with this drug. That's clearly a problem that we see. Also, GI toxicities are prominent. So interestingly, there's a question of what to use first line. If you find a patient with MET exon 14, and typically with driver mutations, we start with the TKIs, but this was an interesting study that showed if you had high PD-L1 tumor, that actually people seem to do better with first-line chemoimmuno, and the balance was toward chemoimmuno versus TKI. But in the lower PD-L1s and patients with brain metastases, the survival seems to be better with first-line TKIs. There are also new inhibitors coming out, really excellent waterfall plots. You can also use capmatinib in MET amplified lung cancers. There's a 20 to 40% response rates generally in the very high amplified patients do better. So MET can also be targeted with non-TKI approaches and can be overexpressed even in the absence of the exon 14 skipping mutation, and you can just see immunohistochemistry examples here of strong, moderate, or weak IHC. The two antibody-directed approaches that we have available to us are amivantamab, which is an EGFR-MET bispecific, and Teliso-V, which is an antibody-drug conjugate against MET. Teliso-V in high high c-MET expressing tumors is quite active. This just shows the waterfall plot for that drug, but it's only approved in the high c-MET cases. But even in the lower c-METs, the median PFS is, I guess that's OS on the right. The median OS is almost the same even for low MET expression, but it's FDA approved only in high. There's multiple other c-MET ADCs in development I won't go into. Amivantamab is the other option. This is amivantamab in MET exon 14 patients, and you can see from the spider plot below that these responses can be quite durable. And then there's another study that's looking at a combination of TKI plus amivantamab with some early response data. So I think MET is clearly a validated driver and a target in lung cancer. It's activated by mutation overexpression or amplification, and there are multiple therapeutic modalities that we have available to target, and two of these TKIs are approved.
Lastly, Dr. Carbone reviews options for patients with ROS1 alterations.
ROS1 fusions are present in about 1% of non-small cell. There are multiple drugs we have available in our pharmacy that target this drug. I think the last two or three are the ones that are most commonly used. They target the resistance mutation, the G2032R, and have high CNS penetration. And most recently, the zidesamtinib. SAMTIV has some potential advantages in terms of side effects, but it's only got breakthrough therapy designation. So let's talk about Repo and Tally. This is a waterfall plot with repotrectinib, and really it speaks to the fact that ROS1 is a clear target here and that these are highly effective drugs. That's a waterfall plot where virtually everyone benefits. and a remarkable median PFS of 35 months. Dominant toxicity there is dizziness, which can be a real problem in these patients. So this just shows that you get responses in both the TKI naive patients and TKI pretreated. So if someone's had crizotinib or another agent, you get a significant response rate in both, though, as in most of these situations, the TKI naive patients have the best response rate. There's also an intracranial response rate. It was 89%. This is in TKI naive patients compared to, this is your duration of response in TKI naive patients compared to TKI pretreated. And so you can see that the duration of response, 36 months in naive, but down to 17 months in the pretreated patients. This is overall response in naive versus pretreated. This is overall survival. And you can see that median survival has not been reached in this study, even out to 5 years. Whereas in the pretreated patients, median survival is about 25 months. So this reinforces the philosophy of using your best treatment first. So that was repotrectinib. This is taletrectinib, was approved last year. It's highly selective, efficacious against G2032R, excellent CNS penetration, intracranial response rate of 76%. These are the waterfall plots, very similar. Overall response rate here, 85%. The median duration of response hasn't been reached in that study, and the median PFS also not reached. Highly active drug. And this is in TKI pretreated patients with taletrectinib. Again, the waterfall plot's not bad. Response rate of 60%, DOR, 19 months, and PFS of 11. So you can even get responses from taletrectinib and entrectinib pretreated patients, shown here in a small number of patients. The safety is actually dominantly GI and nausea, increased LFTs, not so much dizziness. So these approved TKIs really are all highly efficacious, and repo and tali are very similar but with slightly different common toxicities. So an experimental one that's available for in trials right now is zidesamtinib. It's a nuvalent 520. This one has also extremely high activity, but it does not have some of the side effect profile. It is the most potent against ROS. You can see in the left-hand panel, it's got the lowest IC50. And it's got a decent activity in TKI pretreated ROS patients. You can see here with a 44% with any number of prior ROS TKIs, and 51% response rate with one prior ROS TKI. This is a trial looking at duration of response and progression-free survival, which are both excellent with this drug. And it's also remarkable in how active it is. It's the most potent against the solvent front mutation as well among the available TKIs. And this is just preliminary data showing activity against ROS TKI naive patients with or without prior chemotherapy. It seems highly active, 89% response rate with 9% CRs. The toxicity of this, there's very few grade 3 toxicities, and dominantly low-grade peripheral edema and constipation and some CPK elevations. So I think that there's multiple drugs available in this space. ROS1 is a validated driver and important to test for in these patients. Again, it's a fusion, which is best tested for by RNA-based approaches, and there are ongoing clinical trials.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.